You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast, this is located at Rudolf Steiner Audio, which is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. And if you like this podcast, please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collected work of Rudolf Steiner, Volume 316, a cycle of lectures entitled Understanding Healing, Meditative Reflections on Deepening Medicine Through Spiritual Science. This is Lecture 3, given in Dorna on the 4th of January, 1924, and all these lectures are translated by Christian von Arnim. My dear friends, let me tell you that from tomorrow we will do this in such a way that you consider the questions you would like to ask, and then give me those questions or write them down for me, so that in the course of the lectures I can take account of all your wishes, so that all the things you want to raise are raised. Now, today I still want to tell you something which is directly related to our reflections yesterday about human beings themselves and their relationship with the world. It is of no use if here, in an anthroposophical reflection on the human being, we are embarrassed, as it were, in front of those who have views about the human being based on present-day science, actually have non-views about the human being, and if we try to diverge as little as possible from the things which are generally accepted. Because it is the case that in major and significant things, the truth diverges considerably from what is accepted today. The truth diverges exceptionally strongly from what is generally accepted today. And thus anyone who strives for the truth today will also have to have the courage to understand things which are thought of by current science as exceptionally absurd. Nevertheless, it is necessary, not here but elsewhere, that you should concern yourselves with this kind of present-day external science, if you truly want to make people healthy, if you want to mix, as it were, with those who heal from such a perspective of the external world, that you should concern yourself with such external science in a way which I will go on to explain. Because otherwise you will be forced to stumble about with the truth among the errors of the present day. The matter at hand is considered today as if we were dealing with 70 or 80 substances on earth with specific forces at work in them, attracting and repelling forces, and so on. Forces which act through specific equivalent numbers, atomic weights, and so on. You then get to certain so-called laws of nature, with which the attempt is made to create an overview as to how the substances are formed, how they conform with the laws of nature. And then people build a fantasy construct of what the human being is supposed to be, based on the various forces whose origin is sought in the substances, and so on. But it is not like that. Human beings are most certainly not subject only to the influences which come from earthly substances, either in their form as a whole, or in the forces which sustain their nutrition and growth. We have already seen, when we were considering the etheric body, that it is most certainly under the influence of forces which stream in from the periphery, from the cosmos. If you now look at these two types of forces, the forces which come from the substances of the earth and the forces which come from the periphery, you already have the given situation that each organ requires compensation, a balance, the harmonization of these two types of forces. The individual human organ systems vary considerably in the way that such a balance is established. And let us consider the human head from this perspective. Here we first of all have to note, as I have often done in my lectures, where that has been relevant, how the weight which has to be considered in its context in every physical body, how the weight of the brain making up the main weight of the human head, is actually largely eliminated, because the sharply contoured brain floats in the cerebrospinal fluid. So that we can say that the brain floats in the cerebrospinal fluid which circulates through the spinal canal. If we weigh the brain, it has a weight of 1,300 to 1,500 grams. But in humans, it does not weigh that much, 20 grams at most. Why is this so? because it floats in the cerebrospinal fluid, and according to the Archimedes principle, a body loses as much in weight as the weight of the water it displaces. The brain experiences buoyancy in the fluid, so that actually only 20 to 25 grams of its weight remains. That is the downward pressure of the brain. If it were to exert a downward pressure of the whole of its weight, then there could be no network of blood vessels below the brain, because it would be completely squashed. So we can say that it really does apply, that the physical characteristic of weight is removed from the brain. Our brain does not live with the physical characteristic of weight, but with the characteristic which wants to remove itself from the earth, with buoyancy, which opposes physical weight. As regards our head, we are only attracted to the earth with a very small force. That is one thing. We can see from this that the earthly nature of the brain simply disappears to a large degree through the way that the human being is organized. The human organization is set up in such a way that the earthly forces simply disappear. But that is also the case to a much greater degree. Humanity knows about buoyancy through the Archimedes principle, although in a technical respect it is not always taken into account. Otherwise, such things as the devastation caused by the reservoir in Italy, where the failure to recognize the Archimedes principle to its full extent was a technical defect, would not have happened. I do not know whether humanity is aware of that, but you could see it in great detail from the descriptions which were made. People consider those laws to be correct which suit them. They ignore those laws which do not suit them. Now, this is not something that only happens in the human head, that weight is lost through the way it is inwardly structured. Something else happens through the special setup of the human respiratory process, through certain static relationships which occur between inhalation and exhalation. The breath, which happens when we breathe in, is refracted in a certain way, and the opposing breath, when we breathe out, behaves similarly. Both behave in a similar way to weight and buoyancy. So that the curious thing is that in reality, when we walk, we leave our head, the brain, at rest with regard to the static relationships. Just as it is not heavy because of the buoyancy of the fluid, a similar thing happens with regard to its inner relationships when we walk. And that applies not just when we walk, but in a curious way also with regard to our motion with the earth. We only move with the earth with the rest of our body, not with the brain. For the brain, that movement is constantly neutralized, so that in a brain weighing 1,500 grams, only 20 grams remains. Furthermore, it is the case that when we move our head just as fast as the rest of our body, it actually remains at rest. It is more difficult to imagine that something which looks to be in motion is in reality at rest than it is to imagine that something which is subject to weight is actually not heavy, but it is nevertheless the case. As far as the inner organization of the human being is concerned, the head is indeed in a position where it is constantly at rest. All the forces are equalized, except for a slight downward pressure in a ratio of 20 to 1,500, and that there is a very slight forward movement. But essentially the movement is equalized, so that we can say that the human head has the same relationship to the rest of the organism, with regard to the inner experience, as a person who sits still in a car and does not move. The car moves and the person makes progress. The human head has the same experience it would have if it were not heavy. It equalizes its motion when a person moves, and even the motion of the earth moving with the person. So there is something very special about the organ of the human head when it exiles itself from everything that is happening on the earth. The earth is involved only to a small degree in anything that is head activity. On the other hand, the whole of the human head is an image of the cosmos. It is indeed so, that the human head is an image of the cosmos, a real image of the cosmos, and in essence has nothing to do with the forces of the earth. So the way that the brain is inwardly formed is an image of the cosmos, and we have an inward shape of the brain whose form we cannot explain with anything earthly, but which we have to explain from out of the cosmos. The earth only has an effect by, I say this crudely, but you will understand what I mean, breaching the cosmic formation in a downward direction and inserting into the human being all those things which only have an earthly orientation. You can see that very easily on a skeleton. If you remove the skull, you have removed what is an image of the cosmos, and you are left with what is half from the cosmos in the structure of the ribs, but they are already under the impression of the earth. Look at the long bones in the legs, the long bones in the arms on a skeleton. These are purely earthly formations. Look at the vertebrae of the backbone on a skeleton, the rough vertebra of the spine to which the ribs are attached. You have to agree that they have arisen from a state of equilibrium between the cosmic and earthly. And look at the head. There you have a form in the cranial vault in which the cosmos deprives the earth of the possibility of giving shape to itself, a form which is an image of the cosmos. That is how the human forms have to be studied in reality. But if you study the human forms in this way, and also know that the head is at rest with regard to its inner experience, particularly in respect of the soft parts, the fluid parts, that it is an image of the cosmos at rest, then you cannot but say that all anatomy and physiology, as they are described today, are not something you could refer to as the truth, because they do not contain the awareness that we are dealing with something which is influenced by the cosmos. I said there are forces which come in from the periphery as if they were coming in from all sides at the human head. But there is a big difference whether these forces come and are impeded by the moon, or impeded by the sun, or whether they are impeded by Saturn. The fact that certain stars are present modifies the peripheral forces. The direction from which these forces come is therefore not irrelevant. Their action is significantly modified by the location at which we see a constellation. That is a thought which underlies astronomy in a very amateurish way today, but did so through intuitive wisdom in very early times. No one can have any idea of the way things are in reality from the existing facts today. What I have said is very important for understanding how the human being is formed, because the fact that human beings are wholly subject to the cosmos in the head, wholly subject to the earth in the long bones of the legs, is also an expression right down into matter of what lies in the formative forces. When you see a human bone structure, you know that it contains calcium carbonate. Then there is calcium phosphate. Both are important for bone structure. Through calcium carbonate, the bones acquire their characteristic of being subject to the earth. If the substance of bones was not infused with calcium carbonate, the earth could have no effect on bones. Calcium carbonate forms the substantial point of attack for the earth to form the bones in accordance with its formative forces. Calcium phosphate forms the point of attack for the cosmos to form bones. So if you have a long bone, such as the human thigh bone, for example, such a thigh bone could not be extended from the top downward without the action of calcium carbonate. But it would not have the femoral neck without the action of calcium phosphate. That is not altered in any way by the fact quoted by anatomists that the quantity of calcium phosphate and calcium carbonate in the long bone and the femoral neck is not significantly different. Firstly, that is not quite correct if examined in greater detail. They are different. But there is something else to consider in these matters. The whole of the human organism is designed to have processes which build up and break down. Processes by means of which something is built up, and processes by means of which the things that cannot be used for building up are eliminated. A very significant difference between such anabolic and catabolic forces in the substances themselves can be seen in fluorine, for example. The ordinary anatomist would say that fluorine plays a role in building up the teeth. It is also found in urine. So we have fluorine here and there. That is beside the point. In building up the teeth, fluorine plays a positive role. The teeth cannot be built up without fluorine. In the urine, we find the fluorine which has been removed, which should be broken down. The key thing is to distinguish whether something has been eliminated somewhere and has formed as a result, or whether it is absolutely essential for building something up. So that is the situation. If you have a part of a bone which is essentially formed from the cosmos, calcium phosphate works to build it up. In another section of bone, calcium phosphate is found as an excretion, and vice versa. In the long bones, calcium carbonate builds up the bone, but it can be found as an excretion, is eliminated in the direction of the part that has been created out of the cosmos. It has to be said that nowhere is it of relevance whether a substance is present or not. The important thing, with regard to its significance in any location in the organism, is the direction of its movement. I once tried to illustrate these things to our friends by saying, "Let us assume I go for a walk at 9 in the morning and see 2 people sitting peacefully on a bench together. At 3 in the afternoon I pass by again and the 2 people are again sitting peacefully together. If I note these 2 facts, I have not done anything because the following situation could be the case. One of the people might have taken a sandwich along and has sat there from 9 to 3. The other had gone off somewhere and only returned to sit down again shortly before 3. The one is rested, the other is tired out. The inner constitution of both is quite different. It cannot therefore be a matter of whether the one or the other person is there, but what did he do? What existential path did he pursue to get there? And thus it is fundamentally irrelevant for an understanding of the human being whether this or that substance is present in an organ. We have to know in what form it is there. Is it there as an anabolic substance or a secretion? Only then can we understand the human being. You will never find the bridge from the quality of a substance that is necessary for the human organism to a medicine if you cannot consider this process properly. Only when you are able to do so will you learn that in fact the distribution of substances in the cosmos is quite different from what people normally think. It is a striking fact, which people have no longer thought about for as short a period as the last 500 or 600 years, that they think certain analytical processes can be used to show that there is iron in the human organism. These processes allow us to say that there is iron in the human organism, in the blood. But you will try in vain to show that there is lead in the human being, if the organism is normal. Now we really only know lead in lead ores, if present in material quantities. But all the metals which we find in material quantities in the substance of our earth once existed in dissolved, very volatile, even warmth etheric states in their original forms on Saturn, Sun, and so on. Now human beings were already present on old Saturn, in a different form, of course. They went through all these processes in which iron, for example, has become what it is today, from a very volatile, finely distributed, warmth etheric state. They participated in what the world has become, and so on. The peculiar thing is that human beings behaved in respect of iron and magnesium in such a way that they integrated them into their own structure. Lead they overcame. They behaved toward magnesium such that they combined the magnesium process with their own process. They behaved toward lead in such a way that they fled from the lead process. They expelled it. So we can see with regard to magnesium that the same forces are at work in the human being as in magnesium externally. Human beings have to overcome them inwardly. But before human beings were enclosed in their skin, when they were still metamorphosing forms which were united with the cosmos, they overcame the lead process, so that they still have within them today the surmounting, the expulsion of the lead process. They have within them the anabolic forces of magnesium and the forces to eliminate the lead process. What does that actually mean? You only need to study what happens to the human organism when it is subject to lead poisoning. It becomes brittle, sclerotic. Hence we could say that the human organism cannot tolerate lead within it. When lead poisoning occurs, there is lead in the human organism. However, the organism begins to fight the process which lies in the lead substance. Substances are always processes. Lead spreads in the organic process. The organism rises against it and tries to expel the lead. If it manages to do so, it regains its health. If the lead is stronger, the organism does not regain its health. The familiar disintegration process associated with lead poisoning occurs in the human organism because the latter can only cope with the processes which overcome the lead process. It cannot have the forces which form the lead substance within it. If we now investigate what the benefits are to human beings that they have no lead within them, we find the following. You see, human beings are sensory beings in the first instance. They perceive the things around them, and then they think about them. They require both things. They must perceive things so that they can establish a connection with the world. They must also reflect, must force back their perceptions, and then develop their independence by forcing back their perceptions. If we only perceived, we would always be taken up with external perception. But only by stepping back from things, by reflecting on them, do we become a personality, an individuality. In that way, we are not always taken up by things. And if we study the human etheric body, it has within it a center for the forces which reject lead. This center is roughly where the hair forms its crown. There's a picture. That is where the forces which overcome lead radiate out. They radiate into the whole of the organism, so that the lead-forming forces can on no account enter the organism. The forces formed by the body which overcome lead are very important, because as a result of these same forces, I do not remain caught up in the simple observation of this chalk. Otherwise, I would identify myself with what I'm looking at. I make myself independent. I paralyze my perception to some extent. But I do so with the same forces, which are the forces used to overcome lead, so that human beings owe it to the lead-overcoming forces that they can be inwardly unified personalities. The fact that human beings can separate themselves from the world is due to the forces which overcome lead. It is indeed the case that these forces located in human beings, the existence of which can become quite conspicuous if a certain context, which I will mention shortly, is taken into account, are not just of physical and etheric, but also psychological and moral importance. What I mean to say is that human beings take certain metal solids into their body, which they combine with their own physical organism. Other metal solids they reject. These are only in human beings as processes for repelling, for overcoming. So why does it happen that human beings, in the course of their long development, from the Saturn period, the Sun period, and so on, have rejected certain substances which have arisen on the outside and assimilated others? Such rejection, at the same time, includes the ability of human beings to assimilate independent moral forces within themselves. It is indeed the case that if human beings were inclined to have lead-forming forces within themselves, One could imagine that our present organism does not necessarily need lead, but that somewhere it had lead-forming forces, that it contained lead in the same sense that it now has iron, then they would have, as is the case with lead, semi-moral characteristics within themselves in relation to lead. Human beings would have a pathological, today we would call it pathological, affinity to external dirt in the world. Human beings would seek out smelling, stinking substances and smell them to immerse themselves in them. And if we have children and observe how it can happen with children, that they have such perverse characteristics, there are children who love to seek out stinking matter, who nibble with their nose on petroleum, for example, then there is always an absence of such lead-repellent characteristics in the blood. Then we have to try and summon this lead-repellent force by clinical or even medicinal means. It is possible to call up this lead-repellent force through forms of treatment, which we will discuss later on. Let us remain with a substance which plays a certain role in the human organism, magnesium. Here we can study a particularly interesting thing. I have repeatedly drawn attention to the fact, particularly in the educational field, that the first period of life, which we have to separate clearly from all the following ones, extends as far as the change of teeth. The next period goes to puberty. Now the thing is that just as fluorine is necessary for the development of the teeth, so is magnesium. But the development of the teeth takes place not just in the mouth, the upper and lower jaw, but the whole organism is involved. The magnesium process takes place in the whole organism. And that is of key significance for the human being until the change of teeth. After the change of teeth, the magnesium process is no longer of such importance as it was previously, because the magnesium forces harden the organism. They coalesce the organism within itself, and the concluding point of this consolidation of the human organism, this internal structuring of the forces and substances, is concluded with the change of teeth, with the arrival of the permanent teeth. Until that point, the use of magnesium is of the very greatest importance for the human organism. Now, the human organism is a whole with regard to its temporal development. It must develop, have magnesium within it. It would not have the proper consolidating forces if it did not have these magnesium processes within it. But it cannot stop producing the magnesium forces. This continues to happen after the change of teeth, just as much as it did before. They must be processed in the organism, and the key thing after the change of teeth is that the magnesium is overcome, that it is expelled. It moves particularly to the human secretion of milk. It is secreted particularly with milk. Because the secretion of milk is connected with sexual maturity, you can see a peculiar connected process, a periodic process. Take magnesium. Until the change of teeth is consumed, as it were, by the human organism, from the change of teeth to puberty it is expelled. And in the forces which form the milk, forces magnesium. Let me read that again. Take magnesium. Until the change of teeth it is consumed, as it were, by the human organism. From the change of teeth to puberty it is expelled. And in the forces which form the milk forces, magnesium is present as a secretion. Then there is a reversal to the age of 20. Thereafter the magnesium force is used for the finer consolidation of the muscles. Substances are really only compounded processes. Lead only appears to be this rough, gray-looking substance. It is nonsense to say that it is a piece of rough substance. Lead is a process which takes place within the limits set for the spread of lead. Everything is process. We can say that the substantial processes in the human being are not only such that certain substantial processes can be processed in the human being, and others are rejected, like the lead process, which we will never use and for which we will always need the excretory force. For there are also others, like the magnesium process, which is such that it changes rhythmically, so that in rhythmical periods of our life, we develop the consuming processes for the magnesium forces and then the excretory processes. We can see from this that we do not really get anywhere if we only do an analysis and say that the human organism contains magnesium. That tells us nothing at all, because at the age of 12 these substances have quite a different meaning than at the age of 5 or 4. And we only get to know the human being when we know that certain substantial processes have a specific relevance in the human organism. If we want to know how the substances that are out in nature continue working in the human organism, then the least important thing is to study the chemical composition of the substances. We have to study something that is hardly studied today at all. If we look at the way substances were studied into the 13th and 14th centuries, we find the first beginnings of modern chemistry. These beginnings lie in the alchemical processes of the time, which often appear silly to us. But there is something else. There was something present at the time which was not developed at all, what today we might call the doctrine of signatures. The doctrine of signatures was particularly used with regard to plants, but also minerals, and it did not see any development. Take a substance like antimony, stibnite. The particular thing about this antimony is that it has the well-known spiky form, this hair-like form. If you treat it in a particular metallurgical way, you get the antimony mirror, when the volatile antimony condenses on a cold surface. In stibnite, you have the tendency to make forms which are actually quite clearly forms of the etheric body. What develops there looks very similar to the forms of certain simple plants which nestle up to the etheric body. If we look at the substance of antimony, we have the direct feeling that antimony is very receptive to etheric forces. It nestles in the etheric forces. Everyone can see that by treating antimony electrolytically and connecting it to a cathode under certain conditions, a series of explosions occur which create the transition into the relationships between antimony and the etheric forces. That is a conspicuous case, but there was a strong understanding of these things in the past, which no longer exists today. We no longer respect such observations as I have indicated. That is why we are in a situation in which we are at a loss with regard to important observations. You see, we have diamonds, graphite, anthracite, or mineral coal. All of them are coal, but quite different. Why is that so? If people were really willing to try to understand not just the chemical composition, but what in the past was described as the signature, they would begin to understand what a difference there is between mineral coal and graphite. Mineral coal has been created during the earth process, graphite during the moon process, the planetary process preceding the earth, and diamond during the sun process. And if you look at these things from a cosmic perspective, you will also gain the insight that once again it is not a matter of the substances, but of the conditions and periods under which a substance took on a specific, that is, a fixed form. After all, if physically real substances are subject to time, time has a specific importance. Because, just think, if you take what I have said, you can say that mineral coal is a child, is not yet very old. Graphite is a youth, a bit older. Diamond is, if not an old man, at least fully adult. If you want to set any task which requires, let us say, mature adulthood, you will not use a child. It depends on the age. So you can see that simply by nature of its cosmic age, coal has a different task, wherever it occurs, from graphite, which is of a more mature age. So it is necessary to look into cosmic processes if we want to learn to understand the relationship between human beings and what is out there in the cosmos. And antimony has a particular affinity with the human etheric body, and you introduce antimony into the human organism as a medicine, you have to understand its relationship outside the human being if you want to know what is stimulated in the human etheric body through antimony. You simply have to be willing to go into the finer processes of nature if you wish to understand what any medicine should do in the human being. The end of Lecture 3.